the negative reception of the report, both in Armenia and Azerbaijan, was perhaps a confirmation that it accomplished its goal, which was trying at least more objectively to present the danger of war.
Yesterday, there were demonstrations in Yerevan against the Sargsyan government, and the opposition is asking for, well, it has mainly an internal agenda, the release of jailed opposition members and an inquiry into 3 years ago events. My question would be, is Sargsyan strong enough to start peace negotiations, or is peace a risk for the current Armenian cabinet?
It's too much of a risk at this point. In other words, the interesting thing is the Armenian president is in a weaker position regarding Nagorno-Karabakh, but not because of the internal situation. What's interesting is it's a result of the Armenian-Turkish diplomacy that has made any possible breakthrough over Nagorno-Karabakh less likely and, in fact, even further away. And for two reasons. One is because the lack of progress or success in Armenian-Turkish diplomacy has actually bolstered the hardline element and the more nationalist element in Armenia to pressure against any similar compromise with Azerbaijan. The second reason, though, is even more interesting and ironic, and that is, even in the best-case scenario, where if Turkey and Armenia open borders and agree to normalize relations, it will still make Nagorno-Karabakh even harder to solve. In other words, even in the best-case scenario, a breakthrough between Armenia and Turkey in the short term will make any political compromise with Azerbaijan that much more difficult and that much further away. And the problem is Armenia-Turkey may help Nagorno-Karabakh over the long run, but in the short term, it actually makes it politically suicidal for the Armenian government to dare to boldly attempt a second compromise.
Until the Turkish-Armenian protocols are solved somehow.
Well, actually, I'm deeply involved in Armenian-Turkish diplomacy, and we're past the protocols. What we're working on now is actually implementing the terms of the protocols, but without passing them anymore, because they have become politically too dangerous.
Both in Ankara and in Yerevan, in the parliaments, I mean.
Yes. But Turkey's waiting until after their elections in June before returning to these negotiations. In the meantime, there is a direct relationship between Azerbaijan's frustration and sense of betrayal with Turkey that is also increasing tension. In other words, Azerbaijan is not just threatening Armenia. It is actually sending a strong message to Turkey and to the U.S. and Europe that it's not happy with the lack of progress and it feels betrayed by Armenian-Turkish diplomacy.
So, going back to the Armenian internal debate, if I understood correctly, you think that even if there would be a change in the Armenian government, in other words, if Ter Petrosyan would come to power, he would not be more inclined to negotiate because the regional factors are too compelling at the moment?
Well, from a domestic point of view, what's ironic is even if Ter Petrosyan was able hypothetically to return to power, he would actually be even weaker and less likely to compromise on Nagorno-Karabakh than Sargsyan.
Why?
Mainly because Sargsyan is and has been looking for efforts or measures to strengthen and bolster his legitimacy. That's why he was so bold in taking a risk with Turkey in terms of foreign policy. But I think Ter Petrosyan, if he comes back, would be vulnerable to charges that haunted him since he was forced out as president of being too soft and too moderate. Therefore, politically, he may adopt an even harder posture.
And concerning the Armenian public debate, which is the dominant attitude of the Armenian public opinion towards the conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh? Because we don't have an idea of about that. For instance, are people Armenians overtired about this issue, or people confronted with resignation? Or is nationalism and the Nagorno-Karabakh still a very strong factor in public debate?
Well, that's an interesting question. What we see is actually a contradictory trend. One is that there's much more excitement and much more moderation in terms of Armenia-Turkish diplomacy, which they see as much more realistic and much more practical, benefiting them in Armenia. At the same time, regarding Nagorno-Karabakh, although we see less nationalist posturing and less aggressive rhetoric coming from Armenia, most of public opinion and nearly all of political circles have drawn a red line in that Nagorno-Karabakh will no longer ever go back to Azerbaijan. And the real status or the future of Nagorno-Karabakh is less of an issue in public opinion here. The real contentious issue is actually regarding the occupied territories of Azerbaijan.
Concerning the situation on the ground, which are the factors which you believe make the risk of war more concrete today between Armenia and Azerbaijan? Could a war start accidentally?
Well, yes. In fact, from a military point of view, I'm not worried about war. There's less of a likelihood for an official declaration of war. I'm much more concerned about a war by accident, based on misperception and based on overreaction by both sides. In other words, what worries me is Azerbaijan is using the military option for political and diplomatic pressure, which means that it's not following a military logic. Inherently more dangerous. What's also dangerous is, and the reason this time it's more of a threat than before, is for the first time in many years, Azerbaijan is significantly purchasing offensive weapons and has increased the number of attacks and skirmishes against Armenia. So there's more of a danger of a war by accident based on miscalculation.
So what can be done to prevent the risk of a new conflict?
Well, a lot of us on the ground and from outside, in terms of the European Union and the OSCE, are working to diffuse tension. In other words, trying to rebuild a sense of, if not trust, at least predictability. In other words, the message to Azerbaijan is clearly that the lesson learned from Georgia was that there is no military solution for these inherently political questions. And the second effort is trying to de-escalate tension, whether it's consideration by the Armenians to withdraw snipers and other military units, and to try to strengthen the ceasefire that is in effect.
But the UN and the, oh, you were talking about the increase in the military budget in Azerbaijan. The UN and OSCE have asked to a stop to an embargo to a military to give military equipment to Armenia and Azerbaijan. Is this embargo being respected? Obviously not.
Well, what was in place is an OSCE United Nations non-binding moratorium on arms sales. But what we've seen $200 million worth of new weapons being delivered to Azerbaijan from Pakistan, Israel, Bosnia, in addition to the standard equipment from Belarus and Ukraine. And this does change the format and also threatens to change the rules of the game on the ground, yes.
We spoke about Turkey. Which is the role of Russia as principal mediator in this crisis, and namely the role of Russia in the last year? How do you evaluate the role of
Well,
Moscow?
this is the key question. In fact, we see a broader trend, a positive trend, that after the war in Georgia, the Russians have demonstrated to the United States and to the West in general that Russia can play a positive role in contributing to regional stability in one area, Nagorno-Karabakh. For that reason, Russia is not only working closer with the West within the Minsk group, but has also taken the lead diplomatically in a series of mediation meetings between the Armenian and Azerbaijani presidents. The Russians have become much more assertive and active in a positive way. This also reflects a second trend, and that is in terms of U.S.-Russian relations in this region, where under President Obama, there is an attempt in terms of resetting relations with Russia to use the South Caucasus as an arena for cooperation instead of competition. Now, the problem is, as Russia becomes more active and as the U.S. recognizes that Russia is a key player, Russia may be able to exploit the danger of possible war or conflict in terms of giving it the leverage that it lacks in this region. The leverage it lacks is specifically peacekeepers, and Russia may be attempting to use the conflict or the potential outbreak of hostilities to deploy Russian peacekeepers on the ground in Nagorno-Karabakh. That's leverage they had in South Ossetia and Abkhazia, but which they lack in Nagorno-Karabakh.
One could argue that this engagement, this Russian involvement, a positive involvement, if I have understood correctly the first part of your answer, did not bring a positive outcome in the last year. And if we consider specifically the Astana, for instance, conclusion of the OSCE summit.
Well, yes, some people were disappointed, but to be fair, we have to admit that just the fact that the Azerbaijani and Armenian presidents are meeting is important. In and of itself, the fact that they are continuing the dialogue is important, because much of the Minsk group, including Russia, is now working hard at keeping Azerbaijan at the negotiating table and trying not to give in to the Azerbaijani threats to walk away from the peace process. Mm. So we are back to basics in terms of minimum, lowest common denominator diplomacy, but I don't think any breakthrough or progress is likely by anyone, Russia or the United States or the Europeans, because the two sides are simply still too far apart, and there is no political will on either side to actually take the hard decisions regarding compromise.
Mm. The role of the European Union, do you think the Brussels could play a stronger role in this crisis?
I think not only can the European Union play a stronger role, but it should. What we see in the latest decision in Brussels by Lady Ashton was unfortunately a step in the wrong direction by removing and doing away with the European Union special representative for the Caucasus.
Uh-huh.
That sent the wrong message to the leaders here in the region, who see it as a slight or a sign of strategic insignificance. But with the Eastern Partnership, I think there's a greater role for the EU in general, and more specifically, the European Union could and should play more of a role in supporting both the ceasefire and the diplomacy of the Minsk group, not to replace it, but to strengthen it.
Mm. Richard, we are witnessing in these days a wave of anti-government uprisings sweeping all through the Arab world and the Middle East. Do you think that this wave could have a spillover in the Caucasus?
Well, I would think in a general sense the spillover from the revolutions and the revolutionary unrest in the Middle East cannot but have an effect not only in the South Caucasus, but also China, as we've seen.
Yes.
What this means is, with Iran as a neighbor of both Armenia and Azerbaijan, the wave of unrest is already reaching the shores of these countries. But there are two interesting factors. One is that the populations of Armenia and Azerbaijan are largely apathetic and increasingly politically disengaged. But the populations of both countries share underlying problems. And I was in Tunisia in August, and I saw apathy and political disengagement and I saw the same similarities of no sign of unrest, but it took something in terms of a trigger to set off humiliation and rage that accumulated for so long. Mm-hmm. So it's more important that there's a message for the leadership of Armenia and Azerbaijan in that it's very dangerous for any government to ignore popular demands for reform and change. But most notably, from a political science perspective, the regime in Azerbaijan, the government of Azerbaijan, because of a lack of legitimacy and because of oil-fueled corruption, is more closely linked or resembles Mubarak's Egypt in terms of a very closed political and economic system where power has been transferred from father to son. Mm-hmm. And I think the leaderships and the governments of the region are actually very concerned and trying to prevent or preempt any kind of social unrest, because it is now not the political stalemate, but the social economic underlying problems that's the driver.
Mm-hmm.